this house will devour you.
Episode 1, The Storm That Waits.
Marine Hotel, Wexford Town, 2nd of November, 1925. My dearest Elizabeth, I write and hope this letter finds you in better health than at our parting. I feel certain it is no more than an early arrival of the season's common ills, but I am comforted to know that you're in the loving care of your mother. I look forward very much to you joining us at the Hall in due course. These dark winter days will be all the brighter for your presence. In the meantime, I write to you from my unexpected overnight lodgings in Wexford Town. The room I write in is small, with barely space for this desk, as well as the bed and wash basin. So then, why am I here, and not in Kilfaughn Hall in Waterford? Well, it would seem George is as unreliable as ever, if I may dare to say so. A telegram was waiting from your brother when I disembarked at Rosslare Harbour, saying he'd been unavoidably delayed, and that given how quickly it gets dark at this time of year, he had taken the liberty of booking me into a hotel for the night. I will be honest, it was actually a relief in a way, as I was still suffering from the sea crossing, which was, I am ashamed to say, a most terrifying experience. I caught the Great Western train in London as planned, but I was still nearly late for the sailing in Fishguard. In what now feels like an omen, a horse pulling a dray had stumbled on the tracks at a crossing an hour out from the port. I can't tell you more exactly where this happened. The train tracks and the road seemed to be the only evidence of civilization around for miles, with wintry Welsh fields spreading out in every direction and no buildings in sight. The barrels that had spilled from the cart had to be rolled out of the way, but by far the worst was that poor animal. The foal must have broken its leg, and its screams were most upsetting to the women and children in the carriage. For myself, I heard and saw worse in the war, but it does not mean I wish to encounter such suffering again in any form. In the end, I dismounted from my carriage and moved up the line to help the train engineers. There was naught, though, that we could do for that poor dray horse, but put it out of its misery. When I was back in my carriage, I noticed spots of blood on my cuffs. Strangely, it was that little detail that nearly did for me. Not the damage to my shirt, of course. Broader memories of so many bloodstains. I feel sometimes that we have built a shiny steel and coal future that will eat us all. When I got to Fishguard, I was thankful to see the steam packet still at the quayside and pushed through the bustling crowds to it, even as it was readying to depart. The morning weather was calm, a welcome lull after the storms of the last few days. We left the harbour to cut through a still sea with flat November light shining dully off it. There was no wind but that created by our own passage. I had a sudden liminal sense of being at the start of something. But what, I could not say. I stayed out on deck, catching my breath. And once we left land and the seagulls behind, it was just the sea and the throbbing of the engine. After London, the silence was a much needed respite. It was not the last, though. The weak sun gave way to mist, which strengthened into fog. Alone on deck, I travelled in a little pocket world that extended 100 yards over the grey water before fading into the gloomy murk. I fancied myself abandoned. The steam packet of Flying Dutchman forever crossing the seas, calling out mournfully on its horn. The water below the railing pulled at me, and I imagined diving into the flat sea below and watching the vessel recede into the blank walls of fog until I was at last truly alone. These melancholic thoughts were interrupted by a sudden squall that shredded the haze. Briefly, I saw blue skies, and then towering, threatening clouds were marching from the north to envelop us. You have the better eye for nature and her wonders, but even still, it seemed to me most unnatural the way the clouds boiled into being as they rushed towards us, dragging dark, rainy shadows underneath them. I stayed out, Elizabeth, intending to admire nature at her most imposing. But once the weather hit, well, I was quick to scurry to the passenger cabin. The rain was a wall of water that swept over us, chased close by violent, chaotic seas. The deck, a sleeping animal, abruptly prodded into snarling anger. It was as much as I could do to get inside without being swept overboard. We were tossed willy-nilly by that dreadful storm. I had been thrown about in small boats by rough seas, but in a larger vessel like this steam packet, never had I encountered a sea that treated our ship like it was a child's toy, to be rolled, lifted, and submerged repeatedly. The wind howled past outside, and there were great crashes as waves broke savagely over our bows. About 20 people were in the cabin with me, mainly families and businessmen. It being first class, everyone was of a sort in their attire, but one man in particular caught my attention as I flopped down onto a bench. The dark suit he wore, while clearly of superior quality, was also at least a decade out of date. He was tall and thin, skeletally so, with a pale complexion to match, though at that moment, those in the cabin not pale were green. The way he had wedged himself in his chair and with his long legs under the bolted down table reminded me of a long-limbed spider curled up and ready to pounce. The door to the cabin came unlatched in the storm's ferocity, and water sloshed in the doorway with each lurch and swirled around our feet. I let go the table I had hold of and started towards the door with the intent of fastening it shut, when I was thrown by a particularly vicious heave against the cabin wall. The ship dropped, alarmingly so, and seawater flowed in, swirling around me as I sat dazed on the floor. Then rough hands grabbed me and hauled me to a chair. It was a sailor, sent to check the passengers were okay. He sat opposite and studied me, a wiry older fellow with missing teeth and an amused half-smile on his lips. He evidently decided I needed minding and would stay, despite my protests. Uncharitably, I marked him down as skiving off work. In retrospect, he probably had seen enough storms to know that moving about in this was reckless and invited injury. He was an impotent fellow, though, in our peril, giving himself license to be overly familiar. "You'll be a military man," he said, or more accurately, leered. I said nothing. This was a potentially dangerous line of inquiry. "Their army, I'll wager," he said, nodding back in the direction of England. "The lads where we're going have no need of that military bearing you have." He lapsed into silence, listening to the storm and apparently with no more to say in the matter. Since I heeded Redmond's call and went to fight in France, there have been two wars at home, and I've heard stories of the sort of welcome an Irish man with a British Army pension can expect. Indeed, only last year, a British soldier was killed in Cork and others wounded by anti-treaty gunmen, or the Irregulars, as they are called now. To change the topic, I said, "What of this storm? It blew up all of a sudden." "Elizabeth, he was as typical a specimen of superstitious sailor as you are likely to encounter. If you remember the captain of the pleasure yacht we took out from Southampton last year, you will have an excellent idea of the sailor's eccentric notions. For one, the man swore, with unsavoury relish I would add, that the storm was deliberately driving us south to Tuscar Rock. Even I have heard of that treacherous outcrop south of Wexford and the grim scorecard of ships wrecked on it." Our conversation lapsed then, and we had to brace ourselves against the ferocity of the storm. Even as the steam packet's sturdy engine kept us ploughing forward, the snarls and clanks and strange bangs coming from the straining hull made me fearful that we would pop a bunch of rivets and start taking on water. Then, an abrupt light traversed the cabin from end to end, blazing in the windows and flaring against the far wall. The light came again, and a sailor grabbed my arm, urging me to look. The window was not much more than a porthole, but out in the day suddenly become night. I could see horrifyingly near, and getting nearer still. A spear of light reaching out from a dark tower and swinging around on the wildly twisting horizon. A lighthouse, Tuscar Rock. As I watched, it seemed to slide sideways until it was hidden by the bulk of the ship. The sailor cackled gleefully and said, "See, see, heading straight for it. I told you so." I realized then that my companion was mad. As the ship, creaking and groaning alarmingly, bucked and twisted its way to that deadly rock, the sailor let go of my arm in favour of the table edge and shouted, "I reckon there's someone or something on board that the storm wants to keep out of Ireland." Superstitious, as I said. He leaned forward, his eyes catching the gleam of the flickering bulkhead light. "Could be you," he said to my alarm. "But I'll place my bets on that fellow." Followed by a sharp jerk of his head in the direction of the old-fashioned spider I described earlier. This gentleman had his eyes closed and was clearly praying. As I watched, he loosened from under his shirt a pendant and a gold chain. I expected to see a crucifix, but before his hand encased it tight in a fist, I saw it was some sort of bent figure. St. Christopher, perhaps. The blinding light blazed through the cabin again, and I wrenched my eyes away from him to look out the window. The lighthouse loomed over us terrifyingly close now, and I could see, and worse, hear the churn of white water crashing over the low ridge it stood on. The ship seemed determined to dash itself on those vicious rocks and break our bodies on this terrible place. Then our bow dipped low and did not come back up. "This is it," I remember thinking, as I braced myself between the table and the bench with all my strength. Not a bullet in the end, but nature itself. Water came pouring in through the cabin door, swirling madly around our feet and rising. Having tempted me earlier with the empty sea, it would now take me forcefully into its violent embrace. But after an agonizing long time, the ship finally jerked free of the sea's grip and sprang back, throwing us passengers around like rag dolls. And then, just as suddenly as it had arrived, the storm passed by, leaving us in choppy but mundane waters, as if, having done its damnedest to drown us and failing, it had given up. To our left, grim Tuscar Rock receded, no more than a ship's length away. Its hunger for shipwrecked debt unappeased this time, while all around blue skies materialized. I finally arrived in Ireland for the first time in a decade, soaked and shivering as the ship limped into Rosslare Harbour, green about the gills, and with that strange feeling I remember well from France, when the danger you never realized you were in has passed and you're still alive. No doubt it was that old sailor's superstition rubbing off on me. God knows there was enough of it in the trenches. But as I watched the old-fashioned gentleman disembark ahead of me, I had a sudden vision of the dead horse as a sacrifice to raise this storm to, how did he put it? Keep someone or something out of Ireland. Do not judge me too harshly, Elizabeth, for it was a hard crossing. And coming on the heels of your malady, it feels like an inauspicious start to my sojourn in Ireland. As if this trip is ill-fated, and some higher power was trying to tell me to stay home and safe. Well, I am warm enough now that I think it is time to venture forth for some dinner. Writing to you has heartened me, as it makes you feel close by, rather than over the sea. Tomorrow, I will depart for Kilfoyne Hall. Please write and tell me how you are, and when I may expect to see you there also. I miss you already. Your loving fiancé, John. The Invalide.
Clatbury, Wilts, 3rd of November, 1925. My dear John, I was very pleased to receive your letter from Wexford and to know that you had arrived safely in Ireland, despite those dreadful predications of that rough fellow you encountered in your passage. Your maritime adventures on the Irish Sea sound quite appalling, and I hope you have taken enough time to rest before the overland journey into Waterford, as that road has many twists and turns and potential discomforts. I do hope George is taking adequate care of you. My young brother may have let his newly inherited position go to his head, and he has the sense of invincibility of youth, which I know men like yourself who did serve in France have completely lost, if ever it were there. It is kind of you to be concerned for my health. In reality, I am confined to the sitting room here, and both Mother and Dr. Maundrell insist I must rest. It is very frustrating, as I feel there should be nothing wrong with me, but I am taken with a dreadful bodily lassitude, and even the simplest tasks, such as washing and dressing, leave me weak. I have no fever, so it is not influenza. Mother believes it is the galloping consumption, and does not think the doctor is paying it sufficient attention. I fear his attentions are all too thorough. I am looking forward to hearing your impressions of the Blackwater Valley, as it holds so many happy childhood memories for me. It felt like a secret realm, sandwiched between the mountains to north and south, and the glimpse of the sea behind us. So many fine, lush gardens and water meadows where we used to bathe. There were caves too, little known and generally considered quite dangerous. But it was an adventure to explore them with a guttering candle and length of string. When our parents had the time, we would climb the mountains to sit on those fine south-facing heathery slopes with a picnic and know the sea was just a reach away. We did not, however, go to the coast much. There was enough in the valley itself to occupy our time. It is exciting that Kilfaun Hall is now in the family, and I am looking forward to being able to join you and George there. We never visited Blackwater in winter, but I am sure there is an elaborate round of parties and hunt balls that will engage the local society, ravaged though it may have been by the upsets of the last few years. Unfortunately, however, I do not think Mother shares my view. Since poor father died so mysteriously after he took the house, I think she blames the situation in some unfathomable way that is based less in fact than in feeling. Now she is seemingly much more content in the mediocre comforts of Clatbury. We are high enough on the Wiltshire Downs, and the winter mornings can be frosty and bitter, but we are well provided for in the locality. I envy you your future excursions with the hounds. I worry about poor Dimples in the stables here. I do hope Tom and the other fellows there are giving her sufficient exercise. It is terrible to think of her missing the first outings of the season, while I, her rider, languish indoors. A new tenant appears to be renting the manse. Mother saw all sorts of pantechnicons driving past the other day, offloading boxes and trunks galore. It will be nice to think we have a near neighbour in these wintry days. I hope I am up to the challenge of company. I fear that is all the news I have for you in my currently somewhat constrained life. I look forward to hearing again from you once you have safely arrived at Kilfaun. Your loving fiancée, Elizabeth. enjoyed what you've just listened to, please subscribe, review, or share to help us flourish.